when I was in college, two of my classmates were, well, to be politically correct, vertically challenged. They were about the same size at about 5'2", and built about the same. So at a distance, they were difficult to tell apart, but up close, it was easy to know who was who, and after just a few minutes of talking to them, it was obvious that they were very, very different people, very, very different men. One hated his height, hated it with a passion, and he wanted to be taller, and he oozed anger because of that, and was just very unpleasant to be around. The other was just the opposite. He was comfortable in his own skin and had a heart three times bigger than his physical size. He was so big on the inside, nobody thought about his physical stature at all. It just was not something that was considered, not something that we talked about. The other man was so small on the inside that he never let anybody forget about how tall he was. Now, hopefully, picturing the difference between these two men, and we'll use them as an illustration as we work our way through our study this morning, will get us an idea of the discussion we're having in 1 Timothy 3, 1 through 7 about elders as godly men inside and out. Because as we will see, the only men who can qualify as elders are men who are big on the inside with hearts shaped in God's image. Men whose internal character shapes and controls how they come across to others on the outside, regardless of how short or tall they may be or what they may look like. Those things are irrelevant. What matters is what they are on the inside and how that comes out and how they behave. Talked about that a little bit in class this morning about what comes from the heart, what demonstrates who we are. Since who we are on the inside dominates who we are on the outside, for good or bad, we're going to first this morning spend our time examining the internal qualifications: temperate, prudent, substance-free, not pugnacious, gentle, peaceable, not greedy. Those are the things that we're going to be looking at this morning. Lord willing, we'll look at the externals next Sunday, and we'll finish this section and move on to the deacons in the later lesson. And obviously, because of our time limit, we're going to be limited to discussing these kind of just on a surface level. We're not going to be able to go into any depth in each one of them so that this lesson will be a reasonably short lesson. Especially because we're not in an elder selection process. As I pointed out 2 weeks ago, this is not a lesson that's brought or a study that's come about because we're trying to implement or to bring men in as elders. That's not the idea at all. We would probably spend a lot more time on each one if we were doing that. We're just working our way through the book of Timothy. So let's begin with a quick look back at my two classmates and see how they compare to 1 Timothy 3, verse 1. Let's read verse 1 again. It's also on the PowerPoint there. It is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. There are two words there in the New American Standard Version, or in the Greek, that are translated with two different words in the English because there are different words in the Greek. The first, both, one is aspire and the other is desire. Both of them refer to the idea of longing for something. The first one, aspire, means to stretch out, to extend oneself toward a desired goal. It can be good or bad depending on the motive and the desired object. Talking about my two classmates, one man was motivated by a desire to be taller. The other by a desire to be better. Two totally different motivations, two totally different aspirations. The first man, and granted, I have to point out that they were 20 years old at the time, and so a lot of things could have changed over the years, but I can tell you one of them grew up to be an elder and a preacher, and the other one disappeared into the world, as far as I know. The second would make a good elder. In fact, he did become an elder. married a godly woman, had raised godly children, preaches, and is a godly elder at a church not too far away from here in another state. So aspire is a good translation because it points to the idea of looking higher, to higher goals, looking upwards. The second word is often translated lust, and it basically refers to the idea of intense, passionate desire or longing for something. And again, it too can be good or bad depending on the motivation and the object being desired. If a man desires to do the work of an elder for the right reason, he will do the work of becoming the kind of man who meets these qualifications listed here in 1 Timothy 3, and as we read a couple of weeks ago, Titus chapter 1, verses 5 through 9, and also 1 Peter 5, verses 1 through 5. Now, we're not going to read all of those like we did last time. I will read 1 Timothy 3, 1 through 7 here again in a moment. But the man who wants to be an elder, who wants to be better, will work to make his heart into the Lord's image in order to do a good work. He will know that this is not about a title. This is not about being known as the elder or an elder. This is one of our elders. It's not about wearing a title. It's about doing a work, a very important and a very godly work. And in order to do that godly work, it takes the requirement of meeting those qualifications so that we measure up to the kind of person God would have us to be. So let's go back to 1 Timothy chapter 3, and let's read the text. And I want to look then especially this morning in some of the words there in verses 2 and 3. 1 Timothy chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. It is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. An overseer, then, must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? And not a new convert, so that he will not become conceited and fall into condemnation incurred by the devil. And he must have a good reputation with those outside the church so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. So let's begin with this word temperate. The original word is the word for sober and refers to a man who keeps himself free from mind-controlling chemicals. Abstains from alcohol would be a good translation. And the word temperate, the English word temperate, means one who keeps himself within proper limits, exercises and maintains control over himself. And by use, it refers to the mindset, the thinking, rather than the practical application in life. This is a person whose mind is under his control. And because his mind is under his control, then it shows in things that he says and does. And by use, it refers to this mind. Anyway, it describes a mind or heart that is spiritually alert or watchful of itself. Not the idea of somebody's looking out for other people. That comes into the idea of the work of the overseer. But the overseer has to start with watching out for himself, watching his own heart and his own mind, making sure that he is the kind of person God would have him to be. He is in control of his thoughts, emotions, and actions, instead of being the kind of person who is controlled by his emotions. I mean, we've all been around people that are like that. The people that just, whatever emotion hits them at the moment, it spills over and they just have no control over themselves. A man who's going to be an elder, a godly man who's going to be an elder, will be in control of himself instead of his emotions being in control of him. It is a man who is clear-minded and morally steady in all things. That's the kind of person that will become is qualified and begins meeting the qualifications of an elder. It's interesting, though, that word is used not just of men who want to be elders, it's used of men and women alike. And in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 11, it's used of women. Look here in verse 11. Women must likewise be dignified, not malicious gossips, but temperate, faithful in all things. And it's the same word. And here he's contrasting it to their tongue and their mouth. We're talking about the tongue in class this morning. And so the woman is to be a woman, someone who controls what she says. In Titus chapter 2 and verse 2, it says that older men in general, not just elders, are instructed to be temperate, that word again, dignified, sensible as well. So it's not talking about the relationship necessarily to alcohol here in this word, particularly. It's the idea of the control that the person has over themselves. And it's obvious, of the two men that I mentioned earlier, my classmates, one was very temperate and very dignified, exercised self-control. The other one, not so much. In fact, almost not at all. And it was obvious to all who knew them. But again, granted, they were 20-year-old kids, so no, who knows what they would grow up to. You know, that doesn't dictate what they're going to be when they grow up. So unfortunately, one has disappeared. Now, could he have turned to the Lord and become a better person? Yes, obviously could. I don't know if he did or not, but obviously he could have. But they were on two different paths at an early age in life. Well, let's go to the next word, which is prudent. Prudent means a man marked by wisdom, judiciousness, restraint. Some translations use the word sober. But the Greek word here in 1 Timothy, the Greek word translated prudent, has nothing to do with alcohol at all. In fact, it literally means safe or sound of mind. And it's the idea of someone who is in control of their own thoughts and actions, which is why most versions say self-control. Some have others, but most of them have self-control here. This is a man who has good judgment and exercises it in his daily life. Again, it's a charge not just to men who would be elders, but to older men and women as well, old men and women as well. Turn over to Titus chapter 2. I mentioned Titus 2 a moment ago, but we need to turn over there and read verses 1 through 5. Titus 2, verses 1 through 5. And notice what Titus was supposed to teach there in Crete. Verse 1, chapter 2. But as for you, speak the things which are fitting for sound doctrine. Older men are to be temperate, dignified, sensible. The word sensible is the same word translated prudent in 1 Timothy. Sound in faith and love and perseverance. Older women likewise are to be reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips, nor enslaved to much wine, teaching what is good, so that they may encourage the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be sensible, pure workers at home, kind, being subject to their own husbands, so that the word of God will not be dishonored. So the word sensible here in verse 2 and in verse 5 is the word prudent. It's the idea, again, of being in control of oneself. It's someone who is not out of control, not pushed to and fro, pushed around, and controlled by their emotions. Now, do you see a pattern developing in these very first two words that we're going to see as we work our way through the text? It's a pattern there of controlling oneself. A person who cannot control themselves has no business being in charge of the Lord's church, has no business being appointed as an elder. Now, we're going to skip over the next three qualifications because they're more external in nature. And I have to admit something here. The division that I've come up with and the ones that I've set apart as internal and external, somewhat to me it seem obvious, but they're my personal decision, it's my own judgment, so bear with me if you're looking at it and read through this and say, well, why wasn't this one personal and why wasn't that external? Don't get too caught up in that. Again, it's just the way I did it. And you can have a different way of doing it, and that's just fine. The next qualification we're going to spend a little bit more time on is the idea of being substance-free. Substance-free. And I can use the word substance-free, even though the word in the Greek includes wine, refers to free of wine. I chose substance-free for a simple reason. First, we're living in a time where absurd, ungodly behavior is being just praised and glorified and allowed and permitted everywhere. It will not be long before every state in the nation and the nation itself has legalized the recreational use of marijuana. A lot of states already have, though nationally it's still a controlled substance and illegal to use. But it won't be long before it's going to be, I think, legalized across the nation. It's going to happen. Fight it all we want, not want it as much as hard as we might not want it to happen. It's going to happen. That's just the world we live in. And sadly, some brethren will jump on the bandwagon and say, well, since it's legal and it's long, and as long as it's used in moderation, recreational use of marijuana isn't that big a deal. They're going to say it because they already say it about alcohol. They already do. In fact, who knows? Maybe some already are trying to say, you know, they just need to legalize marijuana, quit trying to have all these fights about drugs and alcohol, and just let people do whatever they want. And besides, the Bible never says don't ever drink alcohol ever, 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 ever at all. And so why can't we? That's the argument that they make. Now, since Paul already used a word that literally means abstain from intoxicants, that's the first word that we looked at, tempera, why did he come back to it? Well, first of all, the first word was just metaphorical for a completely clear-minded self-control. This word refers to the person who just hangs out around or lingers near where wine is being consumed. It literally just lingers near wine. The sober-minded man who wants to serve as an elder doesn't want to hang out where social drinking is taking place. Doesn't want to be a part of it. Doesn't want to have any involvement in it. That means they don't go hang out at the bar after work with their buddies and knock back a couple of beers. They don't go to backyard keg parties. Certainly don't host them. And they don't go to wine tastings, and they don't have a selection of nice, lovely wines in their house to share with guests. Not the person who wants to be a godly elder. They just don't think that way. It's not something they want to be a part of. Now, what about chapter 5, verse 23? 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 23 says this. Paul tells Timothy, no longer drink water exclusively, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. Now what that passage tells us, first of all, is that Timothy thought that he should stay away from alcohol. Not even drink any wine at all. And by the way, I just need to point out this. Wine in the New Testament is a word for fruit of the vine or juice. It could be fermented, or it might not be fermented. It might be the grape juice that we use here that's completely free of fermentation. The reason Paul had to tell Timothy to use a little wine with his water is because water has almost always been contaminated. Any of you ever travel south of the border, and I don't mean Tennessee, and what's one of the first rules that you learn? Don't drink the water. Why? Because it's contaminated. And you most likely will get sick. I know we got some folks here go camping. When you go camping, do you look at a nice, lovely, oh, the stream's so clear, let's just get some water and just drink straight out of the creek? Not unless you want to spend all your time in the outhouse. You just don't do it because the water is contaminated. Years ago, my hometown newspaper in Lindale reprinted a bunch of articles from the late 1800s. The city of Lindale in Texas was established, I think, in 1872 or something like that. And so in the late 1800s, there was a newspaper in the town. And so a few years ago, the local paper reprinted articles from over a century before. And one of the articles was a very interesting article. It was by a scientist who came to town and tested the well in the middle of town. So you had a four-way stop in the middle of town. Literally, I mean, when I went to college in 1980, it was a four-way stop sign. Now there's like three traffic lights in town. Whew, got big. Anyway, so right there in that intersection in the old days, there was a well that all the city folk and the businesses there got their water from. And their drinking water, their washing water, their cooking water, everything came out of that well. So he came to town and he tested it, and then he showed on a little old primitive microscope, and showed all the townspeople all the lovely little critters crawling around in this water they were drinking. Changed their mind and they're thinking about it. So before modern purification systems, fermented wine was used to make water safe to drink. Now, one thing we have to understand is that it was very, very, very diluted for the most part. It would be like taking a pitcher of water and pouring, you know, a cup or half a cup of wine, fermented wine, into that water and stirring up. I think sometimes we forget about, we don't think about the fact that in the old days, they didn't have refrigerators to preserve their meat, their food, and their liquids. And so they would not only would they would mix it with water, they would actually boil grapes and grape juice and reduce it to a jelly. And then they would take that jelly and they would store that, and then they would get it out and they would mix it in with water. And sometimes it might be a little fermented, but most of the time it would not. And they would mix it with water, basically like if you went to the store. I don't think you can find them anymore. Remember the days when you'd go to the store and you'd buy the concentrate in the can and you had that little yellow tab that you ripped off the top and you popped the top off and you poured it in the water and you mixed it up to have grape drink? That's what they did. That's how they drank their water. And they made their wine. That's how they had their wine made, and to some extent. They just mixed water with this jelly, and it would not necessarily be fermented. And they also recognized the problem with being drunk, and they would drink a lot of wine. And what they would do to keep from getting drunk is they would dilute it. Modern illustration. Somebody says, hey, you know, I believe in social drinking. Okay, well, it's fine. I'll come to your house, get a pitcher of water, put in four glasses of water, and then pour in a can of beer and mix it up. Oh, I don't want to do that. Why? Because they want the effect that the alcohol is going to cause. And it's not going to cause it when it's that diluted. And that's the way it would work in those days. And this is an issue, though, of social drinking that is raising its head, coming back. In fact, but it's been around for a long time ago. About 20 years ago, there was a church in Florida that split right in half because half the congregation wanted to participate in social drinking and didn't want anyone to ever say, you shouldn't do that. And the other half thought, you shouldn't do that, and they wanted to tell them that. And so when the preacher preached against social drinking, half the church got up and left. Because nobody's going to tell them that they can't knock a beer back every once in a while. Just not going to have that kind of nonsense to drink. They could drink a wine every once in a while. The drinkers left because they were going to have their alcohol. That was 20 years ago, not long ago, within the last 4 or 5 years, I had a long conversation with some young brethren who camped out in John 2 and this passage to justify social drinking. Today's bulletin, if you haven't read that, got the copy of it, please get it on the way out, read it. It's about John 2 and the problem with assuming that Jesus made fermented wine. I think there's problem, a serious problem with assuming that he made fermented wine. So I'll let you read that for more detail on that. Let's finish the point with a simple admonition. Worldly believers advocate social drinking, which is a worldly activity, to appeal to worldly unbelievers. And what's the common thing to that concept? Worldly, worldly, worldly. It's the love of the world, not the love of God, that says, hey, let's knock back a few beers with our buddies so they'll think we're cool. And I can tell you right now, you know what they'll think? They won't think you're cool. They won't think, oh, you know, he's cool. I can talk to him about the Bible. What they'll think is, you're not serious about your faith, so you're cool because you're not serious about your faith. That's what they'll think. So we're not fooling anybody when we consume alcohol with ungodly people. Let me put it this way. It's like jumping in the sewer with ungodly people and saying to the godly people out there, come on in, the water's warm. It's not water, it's not warm, it's polluted. It's contaminated. It's worldly, and we need to stay away from it. Now, we're going to have to fly through the last four here pretty fast. And so we're going to combine the next three. Not pugnacious, gentle, and peaceable. And the last, or the English Standard Version says this way, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome. And while pugnacious literally refers to one who wants to strike out with his fist, who wants to punch somebody, it can also include someone who lashes out with his words. And that's why some versions use the word bully. Elder can't be a bully, can't try to push people around by getting his finger in their face or yelling at them or dictating, or elders who say, we're the elders, you must submit. Say something, brothers and sisters. If you're ever in a church and the elders say, you must submit, I'll tell you right then, they're becoming bullies. Because they're exercising absolute control. Don't. Now, it's your job to submit. It's their job to lead, not to force submission. The gentle elder. Oh, by the way, I have to tell the. Yeah, y'all aren't football watching people, are you? Anybody here really watch just college football a lot? Not a little bit. Okay. All right. How many of you saw the incident last a couple of weeks ago in Texas A&M and College Station, where the Texas State trooper threatened to. South Carolina football players. Somebody saw that? Right, I watched the video of it just to make sure what was going on. And basically what happened was South Carolina came into Texas and playing Texas A&M and was giving them a pretty good whooping in the first half. And a couple of some of the South Carolina players had gone up into the tunnel that goes back in underneath the stadium and were coming back out. And as they were coming back out, there was a state trooper standing there, walking toward them, and they were walking toward him, and they parted to go around him. And if he had just stood there like this, they would have gone around him and not touched him. But he was angry because his team was getting whooped, and he did this. He forearmed them, both of them. I mean, arms here, no touch. Arms there, knocks them sideways. And they turned around as they kept going out. They were smart. They just looked at him, looked back at him, and kept going. And he was doing this at him. The man wanted to fight him. Pugnacious person has no business being a cop or an elder. You're the kind of person that wants to fight people. You got no business, man, being an elder. The gentle elder remains calm and stable and steady, no matter how hard brethren and the world try to push him off balance. Now, this guy could have the power, maybe even physically, especially verbally, to strike others down, to just really get rip into them and tear them apart, but doesn't even consider it. It's just not something they would do because they know it's not right. He is peaceable instead of argumentative and contentious. Self-control. The state trooper was out of control. I don't know if you've seen much of the video of all of the ICE agents in these various states across the United States where the crazy anarchists are in their face screaming at them, and they just have this self-control, and they don't draw back and punch them, or they don't whip their wife around and start beating them because they know better than to do that. They have self-control. Elders, exercise that self-control. I don't care. It wouldn't matter if some person is up in your face screaming at you. An elder never draws back a fist, never loses control, or at least works diligently to never do that. Well, the final word is not greedy. And that's a compound word, which literally means not love silver. That's basically what it is in Greek. Money, and what this means really is that for this kind of for a man who wants to be an elder, money is not his motivation. And whether he has a lot or a little doesn't matter, because that's not what drives him. That's not his main goal in life. He recognizes that it is a means to an end, to godly ends, but is not the end itself. And by the way, I do have to say this. I think sometimes we make the mistake of thinking, or at least we're shaped by our environment to think that rich people are the greedy ones. That the people who have these big corporations and these big businesses and they make all this money, they're greedy. They're greedy capitalist pigs, would be the phrase that some people would use. And that's so far from correct. It's hardly worth even thinking about. Some of the greediest people in the world are poor socialists who want to take everything away from the people who produce and supposedly, in the name of love of all people, share it with everybody equally. But what happens is every time that happens, the ones in charge always get a bigger share than all the other people. It's greed. The poor or rich people can be greedy. The Christian, especially the godly Christian man who wants to be an elder, whether he has a lot of money or no money at all, doesn't care about money. It's not about money. It's about serving God and a heart dedicated to God. Well, those are the ones that we had to look at this morning. Of the two men, two classmates that I talked about, can you guess which one? Well, I think I kind of already told you this. Which one went on to be a preacher and an elder? The one who was temperate, prudent, substance-free, not pugnacious, gentle, peaceful, and not greedy. That guy is the one who went. Now the other guy, the other person, as far as I know, last I heard, had gone off into the world. Whether he's come back, I don't know. I've not heard. He just disappeared. Hopefully, he returned to the Lord. Internal, godly men. Elders are godly men inside and out. Well, this is not the kind of lesson where you say, well, what must I do to be saved? It's just not that kind of lesson. Talking about the work of the type of men that are elders. But I like our traditional conclusions to sermons where we offer an invitation to people to make their life right with God. So let me ask you this morning, if you're not a Christian, will you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? Will you repent of your sins? Will you confess that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and be baptized in water so that your sins can be washed away by the blood of Christ? Will you do that? Or if you've walked away from the Lord, will you be saved today? If there's any way we can help you be right with God, please come while we stand and while we sing.